Welcome to Morning Report Top Stories, a selection of news from Radio New Zealand National's Morning News Programme.
And the Director General of Health says his ministry will be working as hard as it can to ensure the coronavirus outbreak in the Pakistani cricket team does not become a repeat of the virus spread among Russian mariners earlier this year. Six members of the Pakistan cricket team are in the quarantine arm at the Chateau on the Park in Christchurch after testing positive for COVID-19. And in addition, several other members of the team have been caught on CCTV at the hotel breaching managed isolation rules.
There was some mingling in the hallways, chatting, sharing food and not wearing masks was obvious on the CCTV footage.
How many times?
I don't know how many times, but at least once, and it only needs once for us to take a dim view of that. So at the moment, they are all required to be in their rooms, which was the requirement anyway.
That is Ashley Bloomfield, Director General of Health, with us now. Professor Nick Wilson, a public health expert from the University of Otago. Kia ora.
Kia ora.
So when you hear that, what do you think?
Well, this is yet another sign that New Zealand's border control system is just not working adequately. This is in addition to the 8 border control failures we've had since August. So we really need a major relook at the system. And what we probably need is a traffic light system so that things are much, much more stringent for people coming from high-risk red zone countries like Pakistan, the US, the UK, but actually made easier for people from green zone countries like the Pacific and Australia, where you might just need testing and some home quarantine. And that would actually help with bringing seasonal workers from the Pacific, as highlighted in your earlier news item. So we really need a much smarter system at the border to avoid these types of situations.
Does there need to be zero tolerance, though, for breaches like this, which have been warned about previously? You know, don't do this. People go on and do it. What should happen?
Well, again, it's a system design problem. We shouldn't be relying on people being good. We actually, you know, with these high-risk red zone country returnees and visitors, the doors actually need to be locked. They just don't have these choices to mingle. You know, that is a design defect of the current system, along with the design defects of not requiring very extensive pre-flight testing, pre-flight quarantine. And if the situation in these high-risk countries is just so serious, we've probably got to think about just stopping people coming from them until they get their pandemic situation better under control.
So a couple of things out of that. Firstly, are you saying that the Pakistan cricket team probably shouldn't have been allowed in?
If we had a working system, I don't think, you know, they would have had much more stringent testing and home quarantine back in Pakistan. But really, you know, the situation in some countries is so serious that it is possibly a serious option to actually stop travel from those countries.
And because of what has happened here, mingling in the corridors and that sort of thing going on, is there a possibility that this could become like the cluster within quarantine that we saw with the Russian and Ukrainian seafarers?
Absolutely. This is a pretty infectious pandemic virus. And, you know, we've seen many examples of how easily it is spread, with, you know, the inhalation route being the major way it seems to be spread. So this is a high-risk situation which should have been easily prevented. We know how easily spread this virus is, and we just don't seem to be learning as a country from this whole string of border control failures and other problems.
Thank you very much for your time, Professor Nick Wilson, a public health expert from the University of Otago.
2,000 seasonal workers are set to land in New Zealand from January in a bid to plug the gap for fruit pickers across the country. The RSC workers will arrive from Pacific countries and quarantine in managed isolation facilities before starting work. Under the terms of the deal, employers must foot the bill for quarantine costs and are required to pay those arriving a living wage, which is $22.10 an hour. The industry standard is currently the minimum wage at $18.90 an hour. The Minister of Immigration, Chris Farfoy, says the workers will not put pressure on the managed isolation facilities over the holidays.
We've made sure that these workers are going to be coming in mid-January at this stage. And that should be well and truly after the Christmas and New Year's rush on managed isolation for people wanting to come home to New Zealand should be well and truly over. We are apportioning some of the managed isolation facility we've planned for this, so there should be plenty of capacity for managed isolation for those Kiwis who have the right and we expect to come home.
It is a balancing act. Did you consider more than 2,000? I'm sure you'll be well aware that the industry would like more.
Yeah, look, I think they'll quite openly say that they'd prefer more. We usually have about 14,500 RSC workers in the country for our harvest, and obviously that isn't able to happen this time around. We've still got 6,000 from the previous year's RSC cohort, so another 2,000 obviously means there's a gap, but we've been saying for the sector and want to work with the sector for some time about making sure that our top priority is getting New Zealanders into that work. That has been a bit of a challenge, but that's why we're doing things to try and assist and get that over the line for not just the growers, but also the people who might be able to go and pick this fruit for the harvest.
You've placed a number of conditions on these workers coming in. Firstly, they'll have to pay for the managed isolation. Also, they are paid whilst they are there, 30 hours a week, and the living wage of $22.10. Is that quite onerous for some fruit pickers, companies, or are they able to do that?
Oh, look, there's been some challenging discussions to get us to the point where I think most of the sector is comfortable with that. Some have been more willing than others, and I want to take my hat off to some of the certainly parts of the sector and regions who have said that $22.10 will be an absolute minimum for them across the sector as we head into the harvest. They know that it's difficult to get hold of workers, so the terms and conditions there are extremely important to attracting New Zealanders into that work, so we'll continue to work with the sector to try and get as many New Zealanders into that work so the harvest can happen as close as it could do pre-COVID.
So paying them the living wage of $22.10, does that then roll over to the New Zealanders, to the visa holders who are here already doing the work? Do they only get the minimum wage, and is that fair?
Look, at the end of the day, Corinne, that is up to the individual growers. The RSC workers that are coming to New Zealand are very experienced, so making sure that they are being paid for that experience and for the productivity is important. As I say, we've certainly seen proposals from sectors and regions of New Zealand where they are quite willing to meet those kinds of conditions to meet the challenge that they have with the labour supply at the moment. So that's a call for the sector to make, but certainly the conditions that we put upon these 2,000 RSC workers, supply is short, as we all know, so making sure that these experienced workers are coming in for a wage that recognises that is extremely important.
Yes, but is this a bit of a reset, a bit of a deliberate prod to the industry that they need to pay workers, New Zealand workers, more, that they need to improve conditions, and by paying these RSC workers more, you're sending a pretty strong signal, aren't you, that the wage rates need to lift?
Well, absolutely. We've had those frank discussions and the many discussions that we've had in the last 3 or 4 weeks. It has been an issue for some time. It might also, as you say, be a factor in them trying to attract New Zealand workers. But again, I think a lot of we've seen plenty of examples of the sector responding to this challenge. This is obviously not normal. We would usually be getting through the harvest with the number of RSC workers and pickers that we would usually have, and things have to be done differently as a result of COVID. And again, I want to take my hat off to parts of the sector who have responded to that already.
And that was Chris Farfoy, the Minister of Immigration.
Well, with us now, Paul Painter, General Manager at Yummy Apples in the Hawke's Bay, along with Stephen Darling, the head of Darling Fruits in Central Otago, and also Michael Franks, Chief Executive of Kiwi Fruit Company Sika. Kia ora.
Good morning to you.
Michael, Michael, if I can start with you. What does this mean? How many workers short for the season are you, and how big is this going to plug the gap?
Look, we normally would have around 3,500 seasonal workers. We would get 1,500 or thereabouts from our local workforce. We would have 800 backpackers walking in the front door at any one of our pack houses or orchards, and we would have 1,200 RSEs. So we've currently got about 190 RSEs still with us. So, you know, we're around 1,000 short at the moment. Anything, you know, our labour shortage coming up in harvest is going to be acute. Anything that takes that acute pressure off is appreciated, but, you know, probably 2,000 is not enough.
What are you going to do?
Well, we are working with MSD and Ngāti Hini in the north. We're working with Arawa in the Bay of Plenty to put in place onboarding programs to try and transition New Zealanders into work. We're going to do a 10-day program set up where displaced workers in New Zealand can go through and get inducted, get a forklift driver training, a certificate, health and safety, and get really onboarded and ready for work in the horticulture sector to try and do everything we can do to get enough New Zealanders to transition. But simply, you know, it's going to be tight.
Paul, if I can come to you, General Manager at Yummy Apples, what does this tell us? Does it say that you need to raise the living wage to be the regular wage you pay people here?
I don't think so. I don't think money's ever an issue. I mean, for us, the 2210 for RSE workers is a comfortable bar to jump. And I would think that they would normally make that. I would have made that last year, and some, because they're very skilled, very fit, very productive workers. So that's a hurdle that shouldn't be any problem to jump at all. But there is an element of productivity, and increasingly, when we get tight for workers, we're employing a lot of people with either really bottom of the barrel stuff, people that are struggling. Sometimes through no fault of their own, they've had injuries or they're dealing with mental health issues or whatever. So we have a lot of people who are not so productive, and we really welcome them, but those are the ones we end up topping up to the minimum wage, because they might pick two bins of apples a day and the average RSE worker is picking five.
So are you saying that paying that is going to be too high for perhaps some workers in the country, some New Zealanders who might think that they can come and spend a few months picking fruit, but you're going to pay them less than the RSE workers?
Well, I think that the average sort of fit, young, capable New Zealander won't pick an RSE worker who's out of experience, but they should be able to make 2210 without any problems. But when you get desperate for labour, you keep employing people that in the old days we would have tried to coach them for a week or two to get them up to standard, and if they weren't able to deliver on productivity, we probably would have, you know, sent them down the road, think this is not for you, and try to find somebody else. But when you're desperate, you'll take anybody. So our oldest picker this year so far that was signed up is 73, and we certainly have some people. We actually once employed a one-armed apple picker, so we're happy to employ all sorts of people and try to work with them, but some people, often through no fault of their own, aren't capable of being productive, nowhere near the level of an RSE worker.
So, Stephen, if I can come to you now, what's this going to do to your bottom lines in terms of paying the living wage and paying for isolation and during isolation?
Well, it certainly dries up the cost of those people who are a key part of our workforce. But we've got a slightly different situation in central Otago, in that we don't have a population centre nearby to make up the majority of the people we need. A large part of the workforce that comes to Central Otago have been the backpackers, and as it's been well publicised, we're sort of somewhere around 40,000 to 50,000 people short compared to last year. We've got increasing crop volumes, and we simply don't have people. So the incentivising, we're working really hard with MSD to find anyone that wants to work here at all. There's some awesome people at MSD in Otago, and they're doing a great job, but there's simply not enough. And the 2,000 the government announced approval for to come in today is certainly a very welcome start. But we really need the reopening of the complete RSE scheme. We need the whole lot to come in. We've got huge pressure from the lack of the backpackers that have all gone home. So there's enough incentive on the New Zealand industry to find every possible New Zealander that we can employ already. We don't need the RSE scheme limited to just 2,000 people. We need them all. We need the 14,500 the government promised us last year that they would allow to come in. Without it, we can't operate businesses with a totally new and inexperienced set of staff. It's just unfair on those people to expect that to happen.
So what do you anticipate happening this season?
Well, growers that I've talked with recently around in our region, in Canterbury and Nelson, they're already making decisions about which parts of their crop they're not going to harvest. And every box of apples that doesn't get picked is a lost opportunity for New Zealand. So people are going to will end up triaging their crop, and I, of course, see a reduction in the harvest volume as a result of our current labour shortage.
And will that then also, coupled with these higher costs for workers coming in on the orchards, is that going to mean that the prices for cherries, for apricots, is going to go up?
It's inevitably going to put price pressure on. I mean, you can't avoid the link between, you know, wages is our biggest single cost input to our businesses. But our industry is export focused. We're driving our production, our investment to produce export crops, and our income is driven by the export returns. They're not driven by our cost structure. So as our cost structure goes up, we become less competitive in the international market.
Appreciate your time, all of you. We were speaking there to Stephen Darling, the head of Darling Fruits in Central Otago. Also with us, Paul Painter from Yummy Apples in Hawke's Bay and Michael Franks, chief executive of Seeker, the Kiwi Fruit Company.
To rugby now, the All Blacks have made three changes to the starting 15 for tomorrow night's crucial Tri Nations test against Argentina, as they seek to avoid falling to three straight defeats for the first time in 22 years. Coach Ian Foster and the team are under enormous pressure following losses to the Wallabies and their first ever defeat to Argentina. But he's largely stuck with the side beaten by the Pumas, giving them a shot at redemption. So will normal service resume in Newcastle, or will Argentina be able to repeat their shock upset in Sydney? Our rugby reporter, Joe Porter, has more.
A boil over felt in Buenos Aires. Los Pumas, they win against the All Blacks.
Argentina stunned the All Blacks in Sydney to claim their first win over the rugby powerhouse, and New Zealand fans weren't happy, with many calling for coach Ian Foster to quit.
We've got our own standards that we want to meet, and when we don't get to that level, then clearly it's going to come down on me, and I understand that. But I've got a lot of belief in these guys, this group. I know that there's some areas that we're learning and growing as a group and making really good progress, but we've got to prove that on the park.
Foster feeling the strain but not ready to back down, and confident his side will win tomorrow night's test, making just three changes to the starting side that lost to the Pumas 13 days ago. Prop Nepal Aulala replaces Tyrell Lomax, Scott Barrett takes over from Patrick Tuipulotu at lock, and Akita Ioane comes in at blindside for Shannon Frizzell. The back line remains unchanged, with Richie Maunga at first five, Bowden Barrett at fullback, and Geordie Barrett and Caleb Clark on the wings. Geordie Barrett's place in the side was in question after some less than standout performances out wide, but Foster believes his prodigious boot could come in handy in Newcastle.
The first three tests, and Geordie played, you know, scored three tries and really dealt with the right wing particularly well. I felt it wasn't his best game when he went to fullback in Brisbane. We do trust his kicking game and his decision-making with his brother at the back.
The All Blacks are desperate to avoid losing three tests on the trot for the first time since 1998, and hooker Dane Cole says the pain of being in the first New Zealand team to lose to Argentina is providing extra motivation for their last test of the year.
I've been in this team twice when you've been the first team to lose to a country, and you'll probably ever lose sight of that feeling. It's probably a scar that will probably stay with you for the rest of your rugby career.
To avoid another career low, Cole says the All Blacks will need to get on top of the ill discipline that cost them badly in that loss, with the Pumas baiting them into giving away stupid penalties.
I probably let myself down, gave one of the old boys a slap around the head, and they do bring a lot of heat in that department. And if they do bring it, you've got to walk away with a big smile on your face and get on for your next task, and you can't retaliate.
Coles isn't wrong, and Foster says any kind of pushback will be punished by the referees.
World Rugby has said that if the retaliation is at a level above what the initial prodding is, then the retaliator is going to get penalised. The problem with that, it just keeps encouraging people for little wee cheap shots and that trying to provoke you.
The South Americans won't need much provoking to perform, with emotions running high following the death of Argentinian football legend Diego Maradona, who was a big Los Pumas fan.
We were playing against the All Blacks, and the game was starting, and then Diego came out, typical Diego way. And everything stopped. Like, the ref didn't start the game, and we all Argentinians were looking up, and Diego was there, and we saw the All Blacks looking at Diego, and just the world stopped.
The Argentina coach, Mario Ledesma, says Maradona was bigger than sport.
he united people in Argentina, and he gave a lot of happiness to a lot of people in difficult times. And obviously, he's somebody that came from very little, and he became the king of the world. So that gives hope for a lot of Argentinians.
While the Argentinians will be inspired by one of their country's most famous sons, the All Blacks have far more to lose, with coach Ian Foster's job set to come under immense scrutiny if they trip over again. Mō te hōtaka o te atene, ko Joe Porter aho.
The Māori Party's two MPs turned heads literally yesterday when they walked out in the first session of the new parliament. Co-leader Rawiri Waititi raised a point of order in Te Reo Māori when seeking to participate in a debate, but was overruled by the Speaker of the House, Trevor Mallard.
Kei te mōtiri te Pāti Māori, kia riro i a mātou, te kaumāori mā miniti, ki ngā kai arahi o te Pāti Māori, i roto i tēnei wahanga whakautukora.
Order. Order.
Now, it prompted Waititi and co-leader Debbie Narewapaka to leave the chamber in a dramatic start to the Māori Party's return to the halls of power. We're joined now by Parliament Speaker Trevor Mallard. Good morning, Mr. Mallard.
Kia ora.
Okay, can you just explain what is going on here? What were the rules that prevented the Māori Party from having a chance to speak in response to the government's agenda laid out in the speech from the throne?
No rules whatsoever. I had them scheduled to speak at 4:30 after David Seymour.
So why are they suggesting that they were being muzzled and weren't able to talk?
Well, that's something for them to answer, probably because they're not very well informed by their chief of staff, and possibly because they wanted to have two speeches, which, as you're aware, Corin, you don't get on the address and reply. They were originally scheduled to speak next Thursday. I made some special arrangements for them to speak yesterday, and they said they'd only accept those special arrangements if they got to speak twice. And that doesn't happen. Lots of precedents for maiden speeches early, like every person who leads the address and reply only has one speech. David Seymour, when he was a party leader and a maiden speaker, he got his 15 minutes after the other party leaders. I think the Māori Party seem to think that they are a specified party, a party with six or more members, which gets some extra speaking time for the leaders. But obviously they need to about quadruple their votes to get into that category.
Okay, so this is something you sound pretty steadfast on. These are the rules and that's it, and they just didn't meet them.
Well, yes, and what you can also hear is a certain frustration coming from me because some of us spent sort of hours replying to emails, explaining to people what the situation was. I didn't help my relationship with the Leader of the House in that I changed the schedule to have the ability for the Māori Party to speak yesterday, and then we had that performance in the House. We know we have a lot of drama in the House, and you know there's a certain amount of acting, but I think yesterday's performance was
let me just pick you up on that, because one of the concerns was that you didn't allow Mr. Waititi to make his point of order. You shut him down before it was translated.
Well, you heard that he went on for some time. I don't have to wait for the translations. It was, I've obviously been around the House for a long time. I know what it is when...
How did you know what the point of order, or whether it was a point of order?
Can you let me finish, Corin? The first point was that he interrupted Judith Collins when she had the call, and he attempted to move a motion. You cannot move a motion in the Parliament by way of point of order in the middle of someone else's speech or while someone else has the call. It's against the rules. And the fact that I heard him moving the motion, I didn't need a translation for that. I've been there since the time Coro Wethery used to move motions in Māori. He used to self-translate, but he used to move them. I know when someone's moving a motion, and it was absolutely clear to me.
could you not have shown a little bit of first day discretion here to allow him to, you know, work with him a little bit on this point?
I actually did. He took a point of order at the beginning. I warned him at that point that it was that I could not see that there was a possible point of order, and he, you know, insisted that he had one. He started. He clearly didn't. When it became clear he didn't, I treated him like every other member. And you can't, I mean, imagine the chaos if every time someone was having a speech, it was interrupted by out-of-order points of order. It's just, it's, you know, attempting to move motions that you can't move. From my point of view, there's a very clear set of rules that were very carefully explained to the Maori Party, and they chose to ignore them.
Okay, so coming back to the original issue, is it time to have another look at the standing orders around this particular debate, in that the issue was that you seem to be saying that they were offered 15 minutes each and they potentially wanted more, and I'll get more on that in a minute from the co-leaders. Is it time to look at that for these minor parties? When you get these cases where the two MPs, the two leaders coming in, are new, so it would have breached their maiden speech rights?
What do you mean, breached their maiden speech?
Well, aren't we being told?
That would have been their maiden speech. They would have had it right up the front. It would have been...
Well, that's the point, though, isn't it, Mr. Speaker?
Sorry?
Isn't that the point? That couldn't you find a way around this so that they didn't... Because the maiden speech is a set-piece, important, landmark speech, which is different. I don't want to waste it yesterday, did they?
Why you say that about Arena Williams or Ibrahim Omar or David Seymour when he made those? They made their speeches in prime time, and the Maori Party were offered. And as I say, you know, I had a relationship, a bit of a relationship problem with the office of the Leader of the House, because I said that it was my decision about when they were called. I potentially shifted in the end. I didn't shift the people who were scheduled to speak so that the Maori Party could have the prime time with other leaders, like other leaders, show them a lot of respect, and they turned it down.
So just to be clear, do you feel that they were grandstanding?
Yes.
Trevor Mallard, thank you very much. That is the Speaker of Parliament. And we can go now to the Maori Party co-leader, Debbie Narewepaka. Morena.
Morena.
Your reaction to that? You were grandstanding.
Oh, look, I think we all know Trevor, and we just need to rise above this and see it for what it is. You know, we have Rāwhiti had spoken in the reo at the leaders' debate on the appointment of the Speaker. He spoke again and to a point of order. And I think, you know, and actually he spoke in the reo at the swearing in, I mustn't forget that, so... No, really, all we were trying to do is it's the right of the member to transcend all, above all others of the House and get an agreement. And I think.
Well, just to interrupt you there, because I did interrupt the Speaker, and he made the point that there was an offer, that you got the 15 minutes each at 4:30. So what was the problem?
Well, I think you actually, you know, spoke to that yourself. The fact of the matter is, we're co-leaders, and the others who did do their maiden speech, as you said, in prime time, aren't co-leaders. So there is a separation between the two. The maiden speech is an extreme honour, and we have hundreds arriving for that next week. So we were actually pleading to be able to do one of the co-leaders, who by chance happen to be new MPs, and then separate at the discretion of the business committee to suspend the standing order so that we could go on and do the separate kaupapa of the maiden.
Right, so you feel that it wouldn't have recognised the mana of the of that maiden speech if you had to do it yesterday?
That's right, and I think, you know, the thing is, I think where Mallard's been slightly mischievous is that, you know, this was in seconds exchange. Rāwhiti didn't get to actually finish his call for order. It wasn't a motion. It wasn't kupu like that. And I think what we wanted to sort of say is that, look, if this was, he didn't actually want to hear what was being said. He didn't reach for.
Well, again, I want to interrupt here again, because his point was that wasn't an appropriate time to be raising a point of order. That's just one of the quirks of the parliamentary system, and that should have been, that has to be adhered to.
Well, I guess the truth of the matter is he didn't know what Rowe was saying because he cut it before he actually had finished. Had finished a few words. And now, if this was someone who was a member who was deaf and rose to speak and sign, Mallard would have made sure he heard the point through an interpreter. He didn't hear the point through the interpreter. And the last time I heard him speak the reel, he is not fluent, so he didn't allow us in the reel to actually say what needed to be said. He did not, Rawiri didn't interject. When Rawiri stood up, the speaker, the microphone wasn't on. So, I was there. I saw the whole thing. And Mallard is the one grandstanding and making this so much more than what it had to be. Now, in his communications, which we've given to the gallery, he actually told us, his recommendation is, you could go out and be seen. You could walk out. And we're like, what? So we've been trying to be conciliatory and respectful of the House and the rules and be treated like leaders.
Well, some may argue, does this not suit your political brand, that you're that there is an element of grandstanding here because you're able to push back against the system, a system you've been critical of for many years, and say, and now we're talking about it this morning.
Well, I don't know. I think it's okay to be critical of a system that we all make up. And certainly are looking to have some balance and treatment of, in a fair, equitable way. I think Mallard, and we think Mallard, discriminated us yesterday, and we'll push back about discrimination for anyone.
So you don't want any particular special treatment or specialist treatment, I think might have been the word he used.
I don't know how using the official language of Aotearoa is specialist. I don't know how wanting to be heard. He didn't even bother to get it interpreted. And he can sit there and say he's heard this and heard this. He hasn't heard Rawiri. So he is not a fluent speaker of the reel. He did not bother to give us the courtesy of hearing what was being said. And I think you can say what you want to say about the technicalities. He can use his experience. We all know how Mallard sees this. And he's got to rise above this and treat us equitably. We've got to behave with a dignity and decorum in the House, and that's actually what we were calling on.
Okay. What is the solution from here? Do you need you guys need to sit down, don't you? You need to have another meeting here and sort this out so that this doesn't happen again.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think all we want is fairness, equality and protection from discrimination, which is actually what we were highlighting much, much earlier in Section 78 of the Standing Orders. We've done a lot of research. We've been able to talk to Mallard in the way that we thought was appropriate as co-leaders. I think what needs to be done is that actually the Speaker gives the rule and gives us as a party a fair chance and stops sending out communications that suggests himself, if we don't sort it out, like the Sinn Féin, we should walk out.
Mm. Just to be very clear before we go, at issue here was that you wanted 30 minutes each as... And you were only offered 15?
No, that's wrong. No, what we had said is that we understand that the rules are different. We actually asked, we respected that, we don't have the full weight. Could we compromise and between us have 15 minutes? That's actually, we sought compromise. And that's what I think is really unfair, is that we recognise the mana of the standing orders and the tikanga of the House. So we sought to find a reconciled view or reconciliation in it, and he wasn't open to that.
And you were worried that you would then lose your maiden speech?
And even though we'd already spoken and Rawiri had spoken twice, now Marama Fox in 2014 got to speak before the maiden speech. So there are presence within the party's intel that we knew. So we were extremely respectful, and Mallard just wouldn't rise above it.
Okay.
He just wouldn't find a way forward.
Debbie Narewepaka, kia ora for that. Thank you very much, Māori Party co-leader.
You've been listening to Morning Report Top Stories from RadioNZ.co.nz.